So, your chance to shoot back, especially on either of these two encyclicals we looked at today, which are Quas Primas and Mortalium Animus. Mr. Reed.
Yes. Your Excellency, has there ever been a time in church history that the people had to question the teachings of the Pope as there is now? My concern is, how do we know, we as lay people know, what the Pope says in an encyclical or an elocution or anything like that, that falls into the mountain, might be below the snow cap, but yet falls into the mountain and doesn't?
Yeah. How can laity today tell when the Pope is speaking like a Catholic and when he isn't? That's a mighty good question. Firstly, I would say the laity always have available to them what's called the sensus fidei, which you could translate in English by the seat of their pants. Meaning, you know, an aviator can fly by the seat of his pants. This is the feel. And the laity do have a feel for, and that feel is not infallible, but it can be trusted quite a long way. If you read anything that this present Pope writes, sometimes you recognize it's just perfectly all right. Other times you just can't understand what he's saying. And you just don't know what he's saying, but it feels uneasy. That instinct is not a bad guide. Then, of course, since it takes even a Professor Derman, it takes a Professor Derman, who's a qualified and long-standing theologian, to disentangle what the Pope is actually saying. I mean, out of 1,000 people that read a page that the Pope writes, I mean, maybe only one or two can really disentangle it, or really do disentangle it. It's incredible. I think the great mass of people, theologians, bishops, cardinals, priests, laity, they just skid over what he writes, or what he writes or what he says. Well, probably his speeches are more simple than his writings. But when he's really writing, you know, as complicatedly as he can write, or as ambiguously as he can write, I can imagine very few people really stopping to think what he says. So the next thing you can do is trust guides, you know, choose which guides to trust. And what our Lord says, our Lord doesn't say, you know, all of you have got to become qualified theologians. Our Lord says, judge by the fruits. And you know, when it comes to this Pope, you can judge by the fruits. Not all his fruits are bad. So you don't have to say he's wholly bad, but a lot of his fruits are bad. And therefore you say, however well-meaning he is, he's just off base, judging by his fruits. His fruits are greeting all of the non-Catholics, opening wide the church, the dissolution of the church, you know. So I'd say, firstly, you've got a sense of the faith. Secondly, you've got especially the fruits to go by. Thirdly, you'd pick a guide. And again, you choose which guide to trust. In France, for many years, there's been the Abbé de Nantes, who's been quite a good analyst of what the Pope said. At the time of the Second Vatican Council, the Abbé de Nantes was always pouncing on what was coming out of the Council. And, you know, if you had some knowledge of your faith, you could tell that what he was saying was made sense. And he's an he's pretty excellent. Now, he hasn't been infallible, and he's gone off since, you know, in one way or another. You just have to, what our Lord says is watch and pray. You have to keep your eyes open, pray, especially if you want to be guided by the Holy Ghost. Pray, keep your eyes open, pray, observe the fruits, go by your hunch, and pick a good guide. That's five things to do.
Has there ever been a time in church history that this condition has existed before we even anything similar?
Has there ever been a crisis in church history comparable to this one? I think the only one we know of is the Arian crisis in the 4th century, the Arian heresy. when St. Jerome says the world groaned and woke up and groaned to find itself Arian. The great mass of the Catholic world and most of the Catholic bishops slipped almost without noticing into the Arian heresy.
Saint Athanasius
was the only one. There were a few others, and Cyril of Poitiers. Athanasius was the outstanding one, but whether that was quite, that's the crisis that was most like this, and of course they didn't have newspapers then, so we can't sort of look up in the library how everybody was reacting, but that's the closest comparison. And then at one point the Pope excommunicated St. Athanasius. I think it was in 359, Pope Liberius said to all of the bishops of the East, he said, look, don't stop being nasty to me, I've excommunicated him. So it can happen that the Pope just doesn't understand his right hand from his left. Can happen. It won't. Then it didn't last for long, but it took from the council when Arianism really got going after the council. It was only settled in 381. So the Council of Nicaea was 325. It was about 50 years of Arianism. About 50 years. We're now 65 to 95. 30 years of neo-modernism, so we've got another 20 years to go. The Pope wasn't Arian, no, but he, out of weakness, he sort of bent to the Arians. Yes. I don't know how long Pope Liberius was Pope for. I don't think the others were bent quite that much, if you like, but it was Athanasius who held up the torch, who held the line. It's all you can say is that in today's crisis, as I was saying earlier today, for those that want the truth, they can find it. And God will give light to anybody who asks him, which is why the most important thing is probably to pray. If you want to know what the truth is, to pray. Pray to the Mother of God especially. And pray the rosary, and I think you'll unfailingly get light. Anybody who prays the rosary today. I have a friend who says that people are more and more confused and more on edge, and they're less and less capable of taking the truth if you tell them the truth. And he says he feels more and more like just praying the rosary. We may be reduced to silence. There may be a time when, you know, the truth just won't fly any longer, or almost. So
that's where my concern is, because you could tell somebody some of these things and they're not to listen to them. You're denying the pulpit coming up in the mouth.
Yes.
And it's a matter of just the reaction that you're saying the pulpit's not speaking truth or something.
Yeah. You have to. It's very difficult to explain because all of the appearances are on the other side. It's experiences against reality, and most people are going with the appearances. When the appearances are all against you, it's difficult to get through to people with reality. Very few people today still have a sense of reality. Most people are living in a fantasy. It's an unreal world that people are living in today, in their minds. Their minds are unhooked from reality. And it's difficult to get through. And our Lord says, you know, in the Passion, our Lord was silent more than once. There just wasn't anything to be said. He was the truth itself. But he was silent in front of Herod. He was silent in front of Annas and Caiaphas until in front of the Sanhedrin, until he was adjured to say. Then he had to speak. But until then, he just kept quiet. And then he fell silent again in front of Pilate. He began explaining to Pilate. But when Pilate said, what is truth? From then on, our Lord didn't trouble, our Lord kept silent. And our Lord himself says, don't throw pearls in front of swine. It's an interesting quote. He says, not only, don't throw pearls in front of swine because they can trample on them. He says, don't throw pearls in front of swine because they can trample on them and then turn round and tear you to pieces. If you put good truth in front of bad listeners, they won't respect you for it. And they may tear you to pieces for it. So there are times when it's our Lord. There were times when our Lord didn't speak. And you know, there may be times today when you can't speak.
You have to realize, I guess it's more of a spiritual battle than then we are incapable of penance.
Yes, absolutely. And enlist the Mother of God. And the rosary is the great means of self-defense, I would say, today. It's an incredible situation. Yes?
Excellency, on Mortalium Animos, page 6.
Yes.
Number 11, second sentence. And did not the ancestors of those who are now entangled in the errors of the Codius and their former obey the Bishop of Rome, chief shepherd of the soul? Alas, their children left the home of their fathers, but it did not fall to the ground and perish forever, for it was supported by God. Now, my own educated mind thinks that he's almost saying that the schism was supported by God. Is that what he's saying?
It wasn't supported as schism by God. It was supported as sustaining and maintaining quite a lot of things that were Catholic. For instance, the famous image of the Mother of God, which you have in the atrium here, in the main hall, the Our Lady of Vladimir, you know? That, strictly speaking, comes out of schism. But it's a very, very beautiful and very, very famous icon. In other words, human beings are complicated, and when they're a mixture, human beings can be a mixture of good and bad. And God doesn't sustain the bad, but God does sustain the good. For instance, for many years, it's the Roman Church that has supplied the Greek Church with jurisdiction, but they do it secretly. For the sacrament of confession, you need jurisdiction. And I'm not an expert. This is a department in which I'm absolutely not an expert. But the Roman pontiff has supplied it on the QT out of compassion for souls. In other words, the Greeks are still, to some extent, looking after souls. They couldn't do it if Rome didn't give the jurisdiction. They won't admit publicly that they're receiving jurisdiction from Rome. So I think Rome has to give it quietly. In other words, that's because of souls. The supreme law is the salvation of souls. And so if the Greek Church is still, to some extent, capable of saving souls and providing the sacraments, the Greek Orthodox Church, then Rome will quietly supply the jurisdiction necessary for that, even though neither party will publicly admit it, so to speak. I think there's some arrangement like that, which is simply a means, an example to illustrate to you that the Catholic Church can, for the sake of souls, go along with something which is not perfect. Talking about compromising, not compromising the truth, but that's a practical compromise which it's just a matter of it's a practical jurisdiction. It's not a compromise of principle, and it enables souls to be saved.
Didn't Paul VI lift the excommunication of the Greek
schismatics? Did Paul VI lift the excommunication of the Greek schismatics? Yes. Yes, I think he did. There was a mutual lifting of excommunications, but there was no change of belief on the part of the Greeks.
Why not? Should he
have done it? No. No, I don't think he should have done it because they it was false ecumenism. There was no uniting of minds, no uniting in the faith. And they did not renounce any of their false beliefs because the Greek Orthodox schism has become heresy. No, there's heresy involved.
But it's so entrenched, you're saying that they had to give this quiet agreement for the sake of the people who go to those churches.
Yes. The sacraments, Rome could enable, I think this is true, I'm sorry, I don't know the details, but Rome could enable those sacraments to be valid, which otherwise might not be valid. See, I know somebody was writing to me a little while ago from inside Greek Orthodoxy, and a lot of the best people inside Greek Orthodoxy today are thoroughly alarmed at what's going on in Rome. And again, I was saying to you that the Freemasons are actually now the protectors of the French churches, the buildings, whereas the conciliar Catholics would have wrecked everything. And the Freemasons are now actually protecting, the Freemasonic authorities. Similarly, the Greek Orthodox are now protecting chunks of the faith which Rome, the conciliar Rome, is abandoning and trampling on. And some of the best of the Greek Orthodox are thoroughly alarmed at Rome's ecumenism. They know that it's communism, it's atheism, it's anything you care to name. The Greek Orthodox can see that. The conciliars can no longer see it. So, you know, your principles are always one thing, but how you apply them in the case of concrete human beings, there's not so queer as folk, they say in Lancashire. In one form or another, the most important cause in the church today is the saving of the faith. When Professor Derman began studying the encyclicals of the popes, he realized that he began to understand Archbishop Lefebvre. He realized Professor Derman is not what's called a traditionalist, but he does have the faith and he does have a good mind. And when he began seeing just what the Pope was saying, he realized that the very foundations of the faith are being rocked by what the Holy Father is saying. And therefore, the very basics are at stake today. And, you know, if on a transatlantic liner, you've got a gash under the waterline, and then you've got a few deck chairs that need repair on the deck, you know which is the more important. I mean, the gash between the waterline is a matter of life and death. And the questions that the false doctrines that the Pope is at least allowing to be spread within the church are a matter of life and death for the Catholic faith. And that's the most important thing that's the most important thing to rescue or to save in the church today. There can be no doubt about that. He began studying the Pope's writings because he says somebody high up in the church asked him to. This was about the time of Assisi. That's 1986. Back in 1986, 11 years ago, he began really studying what the Pope was saying and thinking. And it was mainly because somebody high in the church had asked him to. He says it's somebody high in the church, it's not just anybody. Because he had already, I think, from what he'd looked at in the early 80s, he expressed these serious misgivings about what the Holy Father was actually saying, Pope John Paul II. And somebody took him up on it, somebody high up in the church, and said, look, would you kindly go into it? And he hasn't liked going into it. It's not been a pleasant thing at all to do. But he's found just how grave the problem is. He didn't know. He went into the study of what the Holy Father's saying without any predecisions. All he wanted to do was find out what is he actually saying. He didn't come in with any prejudice for or prejudice against. He simply said, I want to study the actual text of what he says, the text of what he writes, in order to see what he means. We'll follow the investigation wherever it leads. But it's not been a pleasant task because it's so grave for the faith. And that's the real... anything that touches the faith is much more important than anything else. Because the faith is the basis of charity. The faith is the basis of all virtue. The faith is the most basic... The faith is the very foundation, the supernatural foundations. The charity may be the roof. That nothing is higher than charity, fine, grand. But without good foundations, you can't possibly have a roof. You can't put the roof there with no foundations.
Didn't they say faith is power without charity?
Yes. St. Paul says faith is like a tinkling brass or tinkling cymbal without charity. Charity is the greatest of so there remain these, faith, hope, and charity, but the greatest of these is charity. Yes. But you can't have charity without faith. You can't have love without knowledge. And you can't have supernatural love without supernatural knowledge. So the charity presupposes faith. And where there's no real faith, you can't have any real charity. You will only have some substitute for it. Mr. Tate.
I don't remember whether this was in either Quas Primus or Mortalis, but you had mentioned liberation theology, and either I was taking very busy notes, or I didn't quite catch what liberation theology was. Could you enlighten me, please?
What is liberation theology? Liberation theology is a new school of thought that arose, gosh, in about, I'd say, the 1980s, perhaps the 1970s. A famous exponent is a Father Gutierrez, who's from, I think, Peru. It arose especially in Latin America. And it's a school of theology whereby enough of European theology, we need a theology for the people out here in Latin America, for instance, and we need a theology of liberation. It's Marxism dressed in Catholic language.
Basically, it's a political type of thing?
Yes, liberation theology is very political. And Cardinal Ratzinger has actually condemned it, I do believe. The church has, you know, the conciliar church has moved to condemn it because it's too far, it's too way out even for them. They can't handle it. It's just going wild. So it's being condemned. Theology of liberation, it's basically the liberation of the people, the liberation of the souls, this worldly liberation. It's not the liberation of the spirit in order to go to heaven. It's liberation of the people from oppression by their colonialist, fascist, oppressive, plutocrat masters. It's really a revolution dressed up in Catholic language.
Really has not much to do with theology.
Correct. It's got very little to do with Catholic theology, yes. It's society, yes. Political above all. It's left-wing politics, really. That could easily be, yes. Once again, it's the... You may abjure European theology, but it's liable to be Europeans that will be again be the front runners. Or, you know, they're going to be out in the lead again. Yes.
Sherm, I heard you use one time the hierarchy of truths. I'm going to hear Charlie Ramos that there can, if I'm correct, that's a strict error. It's either truth or it's not truth.
A hierarchy of truths, you'd have to be very careful. In the sense that some truths are more basic than others, and some truths follow from other truths, so there's an order of truths in that sense. But that one truth is more true than another truth, that's impossible. A thing is either true or it isn't. And therefore, that one statement or... One truth may be more important than another truth. But one truth can't be more truth than another truth. And your truth is a block, and you can't punch one hole in it. Any more than you can take... Take a mathematical table, a multiplication table, or a log table. And, you know, if you've got one misprint in the log table, you've got to throw the whole thing in the waste paper basket. Because you might just use that one misprint. It's no use saying it's only one misprint. The thing is useless if there's one misprint in it. It's got to go in the waste paper basket. So, because that one misprint is enough to undo the whole everything. So, truth is a block. It all hangs together. And you can't say that one part of it is more true than another part of it. But one truth may be more important than another truth, yes, in that sense. So you'd have to distinguish what you mean by a hierarchy of truths. Yeah, it's be a little careful, I think, because the hierarchy of truths is opening up to what Mortali Manima says, basic beliefs. We'll stay with the, we can hang on to the basic beliefs, but the extras we can leave to one side.
That's the frame, I think.
Well, that's very possible. They've got today all kinds of weasel phrases and words to break up the Catholic truth. It's terrible. They want out. Too many souls want out of the truth. The truth is like a prison. They want liberty from the truth. It's insane. Yes.
John Paul's reign was rather short.
John Paul I's reign. Yes. John Paul only reigned for 33 days. It's generally thought that he was assassinated. It can't be proved because the Vatican covered up all traces very fast. And Catholics don't sort of insist upon breaking over the Vatican in order to find the truth. Catholics are docile. Catholics do respect authority. But until we break open the archives or somebody cracks... The evidence may not be available, but there are altogether too many signs that he was assassinated.
Could you approve the book, God, God's Union?
I'm sure. What about the book of David Yalov, In God's Name?
Yes,
I think he's an English journalist, and he's obviously not. He doesn't understand the Catholic faith. Whether or not he's Catholic, he's certainly not an old-fashioned Catholic, because, for instance, he was glad. He sympathizes with John Paul I when John Paul I makes sounds and noises about approving of artificial means of birth control. So David Yalov obviously doesn't understand the Catholic faith. But he's fairly objective, and he did go into it, and he came up with undoubtedly a lot of truths. Whether everything he says is true is another question. But I know that Maliki Martin says that John Paul I was assassinated. He strongly suspects it anyway. He's informed. But it's not something that, for the moment, anybody can prove. Yes, Mr. Shepherd?
I was listening to a radio program a while back about Maliki Martin.
Yes.
And the announcer asked him if he still communicated with his dead relatives, and he said he did. Is that where he gets his inside information?
He's Irish, remember. He is Irish. I was talking to you soon about the Polish, you know.
He came across me in real seriousness about this.
Is he still communicating with his dead relatives?
That's correct.
Well, you may give that a Catholic meaning. That is to say, he prays to his souls in purgatory.
No, he made it clear he was communicating.
Well, that sounds fishy, I must say.
Well, I heard the program.
I can't deny what you say you heard. I've never heard him say any such thing. He's Irish.
Yes.
And I almost said he's a little green man. You know, I mean, I'm sure he's not far from believing in the little green man. He's brilliant. Maliki Martin is brilliant. A very fast mind, and a very capacious mind. And capable of retaining an awful lot of material and getting it out in a very readable and attractive and organized form. These his books, some of which are very good, and some of which are. There's something funny about some of them. For instance, The Keys of This Blood. There's something funny about the book. I couldn't sort of get on terms with it. So there's something in him which makes one wonder. There's something one can't quite see through. In German, they say, I think, undurchsichtig. You can't see through him. There's something that isn't quite transparent there.
Is it fair for a number of people, including what you alluded to last night, to take a fiction book and place into it situations which are sort of taken as fact?
Well, the reason he does it, I think he himself says that of Windswept House, which is his latest book, 85% is truth. Other observers say, who might be in a position to know, 90% or 95%. They quote a higher figure, a higher proportion for the truth, which is very possible. In any case, if he puts it in novel form, it's to protect himself.
That's to be said.
And there's no doubt about that. Because if he puts it out as a novel, then any page might be fiction and any page might be truth. He says it's a novel based on fact. So you see, if he put it out as fact, then somebody, he's attacking. When he talks about that satanic ceremony in 1963, whereby Satan was enthroned in the Vatican, he's treading on some mighty diabolical toes. And if he said that this was a fact, and if he put out the evidence, he wouldn't last long. But if he puts it out, if he plays the part of a little Irishman who is, you know, a little funny upstairs, who says every now and again things like, you know, I communicate with my dead relatives, then it becomes very, you see, then he's got a let out. If you play the fool, you can get away with saying a lot of things which you can't get away with if you're always dead serious. So maybe that's a bit of that in there. I don't know. There's something that you can't quite see with him. And maybe it's self-protection, I don't know.
It's very tricky to try to determine where it's coming from with that explanation.
Well,
I mean, how do you know? If you ask any author that said that, he would defend his position. As for me, listening to it, I have to have complete confidence that the man really knows what he's talking about and is trying to...
I think, Maliki Martin, you have to take him as he comes, personally. I think in order to protect himself, he doesn't come absolutely clean and clear. That's because I think he does know a lot of things, and if he said everything he knew, he'd be blown away. That he'd find a little drop of something in his coffee some morning, or he'd go to the doctor and he'd get receive some medicine, within 3 days he'd be dead.
So do we accept that from Andrew Greeley on the other side?
Oh, Andrew Greeley is terrible.
Well, I know that, but he comes across justified himself through little things that he seems to...
Well, he does. I've practically never read anything of Andrew Greeley. But again, he does have certain information. And you're asking the question, how does a Catholic survive today? You have to read perhaps all of these people or some of them. And even Andrew Greeley, if you know how to pick and choose, you can find the wheat amongst the chaff. I'm sure he says some things that are true about the state of the church. And when he says what Andrew Greeley wants for the future of the church, you've got a real portrait of the mind of many Catholics today. And then when he praises certain figures from, say, 50 years ago, you know exactly what to think about them. Or when he condemns somebody of 50 years ago again, you know, you can... There are authors like that. You have to read them backwards, but it can be useful to read them backwards. I mean, I remember Solange Hertz. I've talked more than once to Solange Hertz, and I said to her, what are her sources for... She's somebody that you know, writes. I think her books are very good. I don't believe every word of them, but I think generally they're very good. And there are very few people that say what she says. But I said, what are your sources? She doesn't quote sources. So what are your sources? She said, I read all of the usual books, but I just read them back to front. And that makes sense. There's been so much liberalism, so many liberal writers, so many writers praising up the liberal bishops and the liberal leaders, that all she does is go through those books, and if somebody's given a score of 90, she gives them a 10. And if somebody gets a score of 40, she gives them a score of 60. She just turns the whole thing back to front and then puts it all together again in the opposite pattern. And I think that's a legitimate way of operating. Because there are so few people... in English, especially in the English language, there are very few anti-liberal writers. There's a terrible lack of anti-liberal literature. You know, there's Father Dennis Fay is one of the only writers who really, in English, takes Freemasonry to the cleaners. Very few in this century. Monsignor Dillon did it in the last century. And that's because there's not much of a market in English for anti-Masonic writing, even amongst Catholics. Your book won't sell. And if you try writing a book at all severely critical of the American Constitution, it's not a book that's going to find many people to buy it amongst Americans. There's no market for anti-liberalism. So there's not much anti-liberal writing. So if you want to write anti-liberal, you've not got many source books. So you have to read the liberals and then turn it back to front. So you take somebody like Andrew Greeley and you read him back to front. You take somebody like Malachi Martin and you make allowances for the fact that he does cover his traces by presenting fact as fiction. That protects him. Admit that it does protect him. It enables him to get out a lot of things which he wouldn't otherwise be able to get out.
I still have trouble with communication. If I could ever get a way to communicate with him, I would ask him that question directly, because it bothers me. I mean, I've never heard of anybody communicating. If he was serious, it sounded serious to me. It kind of destroys credibility, sort of.
Oh, I know. Oh, I know. Yes, but
I don't know.
As I say, there's something you can't quite see in Malachi Martin. His past history. I mean, he's brilliant. One, I'm sure he has the faith. I met him a few years back, and I'm sure he's close to death. He had a massive heart attack a few years ago. He's getting close to meeting his maker. Because he has the faith, I think he's wanting now to get truth out in such a way that he doesn't get himself killed for it. But I think he's wanting to tell the truth. He's appearing on lots of talk radio, and he's saying a lot of Catholic things on that talk radio. I'm not saying everything is 100%, but he's saying a lot of Catholic things, and a lot of people are listening. He's getting the word out to a huge audience, I do believe. He goes all over the country. He's not in good health, but he goes all over the country to take in order to get these things out. I don't believe every word he says, but I hand it to him. He has got courage. I'm sure he has the faith.
On the cover of his book, he said he couldn't get anybody to print his book if he wrote that Roosevelt House in
Possible. You know, if he wrote the whole truth as truth, it's possible he couldn't get he certainly couldn't get a major publisher. Who did Doubleday, was it?
Doubleday,
yes. You couldn't get a major publisher. It's absolutely true. He knows his market. He knows he's smart. And he even gets Jewish publishers to publish his books. Simon and Schuster, you know. Sorry?
Hostage to the Devil, good or bad.
I don't remember the book. I'm again, yeah, it's there's elements of truth in it, I'm sure. But it's iffy. There's something one can't quite see clearly in this case. But I think, personally, I think that as he's got closer to death, so the proportion of truth has gone up. The proportion of, you know, the contribution of the little green man has gone down, the contribution of truth has gone up. But there are the two there. There is a little green man inside Maliki Martin, I do believe. He's Irish. That's you know, he's Irish. Says a lot about him. I think he's very lovable, actually. And he is kind. He's personally very kind. He's played with the truth, you might say. Gosh, only God can judge. Really, only God can judge, you know. But I think there's a lot more positive than negative, too, so I personally believe.
Not
in
Islam,
it's
secular.
Well, yeah, you know,
what's the difference?
Leisa, if a priest, I believe if a priest is, I don't know the difference. I'm not a canon lawyer, that's just not my department. But I think if a priest is laicized, he cannot come back to the priesthood. That's probably what Maliki Martin means. Whereas if he's secularized, then, I don't know. I don't know. Again, that's one of those shadowy areas of his life. I don't know.
Supposedly, so he could write in this manner that he's doing. Supposedly.
I don't know. An interesting man, for sure. Yes.
A lot of these radio talk shows, I don't know which one he's talking about, but they regularly interview people who commune with the dead and creatures in outer space. He might
yes.
just be fitting in with the guests. I don't think it's on the realm of possibility.
He's playing to the gallery. Mm-hmm. Perfectly possible. Perfectly possible. He's very human. He's very warm. And he's very, very much an audience man. And it's possible that he is saying what he knows his audience will pick up on. A man is not entitled to say that if it's not true, even if the audience will pick up on it. If it's not true, he's not entitled to say it. Whether Malik, I don't know. That's a typical example of one of those grey areas with Maliki. He's a little grey-green man. He's a green man with grey areas, but he's brilliant and he's lovable and he says a lot of true things. I do believe he's getting a lot of truth out to a lot of people. It's not 100%, it's not undiluted truth, but there's a lot of truth in what he's getting out, I do believe. I would be rather more positive about him than negative. I think I listened to three tapes of his that he put out about 2 years ago. What was it called? They were very good.
The Shipwreck.
The Shipwreck. Yes, something like that.
He Peter in Chains a couple years ago.
Peter in Chains.
The latest ones that he's got out on catalog right now, I haven't
heard the latest. I think he has done another three since the three that I'm talking about. The three that I'm talking about are a date from about a year, 2 years ago, I think. But I listened to them not expecting much, but I would say they were good. And there was an analysis firstly of the bishops, an analysis secondly of the Pope, and thirdly an analysis of what people should do. And each tape was good. The bishops, he knows these bishops. And he said, they've got a problem of faith, and it's a problem that goes back 20, 30, 40 years. And they've sold their souls. They've sold their episcopal souls. They're not doing their job. He said it very clearly. Then his analysis of the Pope, he said the Pope's suffers, I think, he said the Pope is Polish. That explains a lot. Because ecumenism is part of the Polish tradition. And I'm sure that's true. And then he says also that the Holy Father suffers from German existential philosophy. And I'm sure that's true. See, and it was quite well done. It wasn't deep, but I think it was on target. And his tapes are very popular. They're very accessible to ordinary people. All of that, I think, is to the good. And then the third tape, what people should do, and he said, get to the real Mass. He said, wherever you find the real Mass around you, and then he said, devotions, practice Catholic devotions. And again, you can't really argue with that. It's wise. And he's a great believer in those devotions of his Irish childhood. You know, the Naveena, the Sacred Heart, all of those. And there's a great deal in them.
Speaking of that, the position is that the new Mass and the sacraments, they're valid, is that right? Depending upon who's doing their vows, is that right?
What the Archbishop always used to say was, they are not automatically invalid, which is very carefully said. In other words, they can be valid. But he said, with the present ordinations being done by bishops with doubtful, more and more doubtful intentions, you may have more and more doubtfully valid young priests, in which case, of course, you've automatically got more and more doubtfully valid masses. Invalidity must be on the increase all the time. Now, what is valid and what is invalid? Question mark. God knows. Again, all you can do is judge by the fruits.
I have no problem with that. But if you accept the minister of the sacrament, the sacraments themselves and the Mass are valid.
They're not necessarily invalid.
Let's go back to Malachi.
Yes.
Well, I would like to put in a plug for those gentlemen who would like to go a little deeper into Quas Primus. There's an excellent book put out by the Inseratio Press called Christ, the King of Nations. It's an excellent in catechism form book that is quite Catholic.
Yes, possibly. Possibly. Who is it by?
Father, I'm sorry.
Yeah. There are some good books. Again, you've got to sift the wheat from the chaff. But there are Instauratio Press. I forget who that is. It means restoration. There are, obviously Tan is putting out a lot of good books. They're good books of yesterday, but they're still good books. A good Catholic book of yesterday is a good Catholic book today. There's a lot of literature that Tan is keeping in circulation, which is excellent. And there are other good printing presses, so, you know.
Yes, so some small amount came around. He was at this radio in Detroit, and somebody asked him about the society, and he said, the masses are valid, you can confirm by the bishops, and supposedly from that, there was an increase of people going to the rest.
That's fruits. Those are fruits. He reaches a lot of people that the society can't get anywhere near. There are a lot of Catholics that won't come anywhere near the society. We're excommunicated, we're schismatic, we're not Catholic. Maliki can get through to those people because he's not, in that respect, burned, so to speak. So it takes all sorts.
Is that a valid reason, like he and Michael Davis, that they wouldn't join the society? Would that be valid?
That is a question of truth. If they are following the truth as they see it, that's valid. But if they are not following the truth as they see it, if they're trying to stay in with somebody, then that's not valid, so to speak. Is that the answer to your question?
Yes.
Yes.
Here to comment on.
Have you? I beg your pardon. Have your question. Father Gruner, judged by his fruits, and the fact that a man can be judged by his enemies. Father Gruner has bitter enemies in Rome who are doing everything to shut him down, and that's a very good sign. Apparently, Father Gruner, I don't know for certain, I haven't rung him up to ask, it's not my business to ring him up and ask, but I've heard that he celebrates the old Mass whenever he can, the Tridentine Mass whenever he can, but I think he is still liable on public occasions to celebrate the new Mass. That's my best information. It may be out of date. Maybe he's now, undoubtedly, if it was his choice, I'm sure that he would always celebrate the old Mass. He has done heroic work to get out the message of Our Lady of Fatima. Again, that's fruits. And the result is he's earned himself the bitter enmity of Rome. And the Romans are doing everything to discredit him, to suspend him, to shut him down, to stop him. That's a very good sign. I don't think he's always prudent, but by golly, he has guts. I mean, he's trying to get together those bishops' meetings. It was... Yes, he's... But, you know, he's had to disguise exactly how many bishops actually came, I think, to the last two of them. Because, again, when he's tried to get that, Rome has done everything to keep the bishops away from him, which, again, is a good sign.
They've actually put out notices in the Wanderer, who was
Yes, yes. The Rome has done everything to keep the bishops away from him, to stop him organizing these bishops' meetings, because when he holds these bishops' meetings, he tells the bishops all about Fatima. These bishops learn all about Fatima, and they learn how important it is that they want to be with the Pope in consecrating Russia to the Immaculate Heart. And these dear simple bishops, a number of whom come from the Third World, believe what he says, and of course he's right. But it's, I was saying to the other day, when it's not the Pope that's leading the bishops, it's very difficult. And Father Gruner is working against the grain of the church. It's heroic, but not, and perhaps to some extent, to a greater or lesser extent, misguided. God is judge. I'm not sure that it's exactly prudent, everything he does, but I think it's very brave, and I'm sure he's well-intentioned. And it certainly earns him the right enemies, which is a good sign.
He was physically beaten up in
Fatima, yes.
In the Basilica, right? In the Basilica.
Yes, by one of the priests who's in charge of the sanctuary, I think, yes. Again, he steps on toes, he's got a lot of courage. That doesn't mean to say that everything he does is wise, but he's certainly, I wouldn't mind being in his shoes at the particular judgment. I'm sure that Our Lady will shoo him through the particular judgment, whatever faults or mistakes he's made. I think she will ease him through, because he's worked like a Trojan for her. He's done tremendous work. He's published excellent books. The Whole Truth About Fatima by Brother Michael of the Holy Trinity is excellent. And he's the one that's got that out. And again, those are the fruits, which are very good. He's got out the fourth volume, too, by, what is it, a different brother. Because the Brother Michael of the Holy Trinity was due to write a fourth volume, and then went off into the Charterhouse, into a novice order monastery. And so he left his notes to one of his... He left his notes behind, and from his notes... one of his colleagues made up the fourth book, but which is good, and it's interesting. It might not be as good as it would have been if Brother Michael had written it.
Kind of Sunday first.
Yes, plus there is some more material on the Second Vatican Council and after the aftermath. But I think if Brother Michael had written it, it would have been purely the aftermath, which would have been very interesting. Fatima through Vatican II. And after Vatican II, I wish we'd had that book. But
you can get it.
You can get the Volume 4 that was written by the other brother, but I wish we'd had the Volume 4 written by Brother Michael. That's what I... Yes.
Do you subscribe to the HPR?
What's the HPR?
I'm an American pastor. No. By Father Kenneth.
No, no. Father Kenneth Baker, the Homiletic and Pastoral Review. He's a Jesuit, and most of those Jesuits are nobbled by obedience. That's to say they're paralyzed by their fourth vow of obedience to the Holy See. It's interesting that the Jesuits were formed at the time of the... They go back to the Counter-Reformation, of course. And Ignatius, St. Ignatius, when he set up the Jesuits, he made them take the usual three vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience... But then he made them take a fourth vow of doubled obedience to the Holy Father. And the hallmark of the Jesuits would be they called it a corpse-like, a cadaverous or cadaveric obedience to the Holy See. And the hallmark of Jesuits has been their blind obedience. And this was magnificent so long as the Pope was in his right mind. But in these last few years, when the Pope hasn't been in his right mind, when the Popes have been liberal to a greater or lesser extent, the Jesuits have just gone way off the rails because they've obeyed blindly. The Pope's gone wrong. There have been very few Jesuits in any country of the world that have stepped out and are working for Catholic tradition. Father Schell in California is one of them. Father Trinchard, I think, is a Jesuit, now in Louisiana, and he is standing up for the old mass now, for instance.
How about Paul Crane?
Father Crane in England was conservative, never really traditional. There's Father Dunn, I think he's a Jesuit, in California also.
Yeah.
There are a few, but they're not usually front runners, because peat merchants. I mean, let's say that the Jesuits were the leaders of this school of thought and of this school of obedience whereby the people in uniform come first and the truth comes second. The old saying is there are eight miracles in the Catholic Church. I can only remember four of them. One is to find a clean Franciscan. Another is to find a poor Benedictine. Another is to find a humble Dominican. And a fourth is to find a straight Jesuit. Jesuits are famous for their, you know, that's why, there are not many of them. They used to be the leaders. And I think Father Baker of the Homiletical and Pastoral Review, I mean, he's undoubtedly an intelligent man, and he publishes a lot of truth. But on the bottom line, he's definitely conservative and not traditional. I'm sure he condemns the Society of Pius X as schismatic, disobedient, excommunicated, and all the rest. And therefore, when it really comes down to the wire, he will fail you. He will get a lot of things right that everybody got right yesterday, but the difference of what's gone slip today, he won't get it right, I don't think. He will publish, for instance, a young priest's complaints about everything going on in the church. And it's a very good complaint. I think this was a few years ago. Somebody said...
The pastor.
Yes.
The pastor too.
Yes. But you see, again, it's the priest who's behind the Pope against all the big bad bishops. Well, you see, that's inadequate. It's not enough, because the Pope is the problem. The Pope is the central problem. It's very pious to take the position, you know, the Pope is a good guy, and it's all the bishops around him, and the cardinals around him, and the Freemasons around him are the problem. But unfortunately, that's just not true. Yes, there you are, I see. Yes, it's just not true. The problem with the Pope is his German philosophy. As a Polish child, I mean, Poland's a very Catholic country. As a Polish child, I'm sure he absorbed the Catholic faith with his mother's milk. But then when he was a student, he got into existentialism and phenomenology, and that's deadly. And this modern philosophers unhook your mind from reality, and his mind is unhooked from reality. And therefore, you can think anything you like. When your mind is unhooked from reality, you can think anything you like. And so there's the Catholic faith on one side and then unreal philosophy on the other. It makes it makes a terrible mixture. And when the Catholic faith is filtered through the modern philosophy, like I was saying the other day, when the structure of your mind is crooked, you can take wonderful truth and you squeeze it through this crooked structure, it comes out mincemeat the other end. And he makes mincemeat of the Catholic faith. That's the kind of thing Malachi Martin examines in his tape on the Pope. He goes into it a little. So I don't trust Father Baker's good on all of the questions of yesteryear, but the questions of today, I don't think you'll find he's good on.
You find a wanderer sits on the fence a lot?
The wanderer. I like Joseph Sobran, usually, and I like Patrick Buchanan. Those are the two I would always read in The Wanderer. The Wanderer is useful to know what's going on, but to know what's going on in the conciliar church, but it's hopeless for the modern problem.
It's just... It's so grand letter, monthly letter, which I
get. Yes. Again, he leaves quite a bit to be desired, but he's got a mind, and he's quite handsomely politically incorrect. I mean, he's certainly not... he doesn't move in lockstep with all of the idiots, that's for sure. But he believes in the Constitution. In politics, his answer is to come back to the Constitution. But the Constitution is not the answer. You can't solve today's problems with the American Constitution. He said that, if only we could restore... what does he call it? Constitutional rule or respect for the Constitution, if only the judges and everybody would go by the Constitution, we could control this federal monster. But the federal monster grew out of that Constitution, grew organically out of that Constitution. Mr. Perry?
I would just point out, we should be thankful the Supreme Court has never read the Constitution the way it's written. I mean, if you read the First Amendment, Congress shall make no law abridging freedom of speech. That means kiddie porn running wild.
Yeah.
That means no libel laws. Yeah. I mean, the court has wisely said they couldn't have been serious.
Yes.
You can't read this document that way. We should be thankful the court hasn't refused to read the Constitution, well, literally.
That's an interesting point. The Constitution was made by, let's be kind, decent men who didn't really know what they were doing. They meant well, but they, as liberals, they just did not know what a country needs by way of a constitution in order to preserve morals and decency. They relied upon morals and decency surviving without providing in the Constitution the means to... But in any case, constitutions are not the answer. They never will be the answer. Because if you have... A constitution is simply a piece of paper. And if you have good men and a bad constitution, it's going to work. And if you have a bad constitution... I'm sorry, if you have a bad constitution and good men, it'll work. If you have bad men and a good constitution, it's never going to work. The American Constitution could be angelic. But when you see how they drive a cart and horses through it, it's, as you say, it's not angelic. It's, but even what is good in it, they're now making a monkey of. And therefore, a constitution is not the answer. Therefore, Joseph Sobran is not all that smart. The system is gone. And to be able to do anything inside the system, you have to compromise in a deadly way. And if you refuse to compromise, you'll never be admitted into the system. And therefore the system kills whatever it touches. The system is liberal in its grain. And if you want to do something valuable, you can't work with it. You know, people say to us, why don't you, oh, you've got the faith, you've got so much running for you, why don't you come back inside the church and work from inside the church in order to defend the faith and so on? You can't defend the faith inside the conciliar church. Because you have to make admissions. You have to drop a few grains of incense in honor of liberal principles, which destroy everything that you would try to do, which contradict everything you would try to do in defense of the truth, of the faith. The system is gone. And it's only... Why do people rely upon these systems? Because the systems are substituting for the faith. They don't want to run civilization by the Catholic faith. They don't want to run civilization by Christ the King. Because that would be medieval, it would be obscurantist, it would be backwards, it would be Catholic, it would be all kinds of terrible things. It would be fascist, it would be colonist, and so on and so on. All right, then they have to make a substitute. The British Empire, the British Parliament, the British way of life, those are substitutes. They won't fly in the end. And then the American Constitution, or is it the French Republic? The French Republic has gone from one disaster to another ever since the French Revolution. But men just don't want to believe it. The Frenchmen just don't want to believe it. They cling hold of their republic. They don't want to go back to God. All of these substitutes for God and these substitutes for God's church are doomed from the start. But men cling to them because they don't want to go back to God's answers. It's simple. And it's deadly.
Isn't that the same thing that's true with the indulgent mass?
That is to say?
That's the substitute. As long as they're walking around, they don't have got my incense, as long as I've got my mass, I'm going to eat.
Yes. Yes, that's it. The mass is... There was a time when the mass was the central battleground, but it was never the whole war. And perhaps the mass is still the central battleground. But if Rome is now willing to give people the mass, the true mass, then it can no longer be the central battleground. Or that there are strings attached to the true mass. And you won't get the true faith. They will oblige you to acknowledge that the new mass is valid. Or they will oblige you to acknowledge that Vatican II is valid. Or they will oblige you to drop those grains of incense to the new church. And depending on whether, if you're a layman, you drop a few grains, well, that's fine, that's enough. If you're a priest, they'll oblige you to drop more than rather more than a few grains of incense, and so on and so on.
Now they're even arguing about the Ecclesia Dei, whether the Pope had intended it for anybody past a certain age, nobody younger could be to it.
Yeah, it's they're crooks, and you have to bow the knee to Baal in one shape, size, or form in order to get on with them. That's clear. And in order not to bow the knee to Baal, you can't have much to do with them, unfortunately. And
isn't it just a ploy to get the people away from the
society
of pious priests?
Yes.
Because if they were really sincere about it, they'd have their seminarians learn how to say things. Right?
It's clear from the fact that the indult masses are nearly always started up within striking distance of an old mass which is already there. That's observable all over the country. And therefore, which?
St. Paul, he had a problem. He had an old stanchion over the big lid in society over the church in St. Paul, and Wayne Parker, he moved to the cathedral.
Yeah, the indult masses moved deliberately close to an already existing Tridentine mass in order to pull people away from the wicked society. That's the only purpose. It's very clear. It does to some extent work. Otherwise they would have stopped it. The moment it stops yanking souls from the society and from society masses, they will give it up. And if the society collapsed, all of those indult masses would instantaneously be shut down. That's very clear.
Your friend Mahoney in L.A., though.
My friend Mahoney?
He really berated a priest who was doing the indult mass because he was recruiting young people.
Ah.
See?
Clear. Yeah. Clear.
Oh, yeah.
Clear as day.
Oh, yeah. There was an article in the paper about it. He really said that that's not the reason he approved the indult.
They're crooks. And to entrust the faith to them is to put the fox in charge of the chicken house, or the chicken run. They're foxes, and they will eat up the chickens. They won't all eat them up immediately, because if they immediately began eating, well, the rest of the chickens would run away. So they quietly eat one or two when the other chickens aren't looking, then they'll quietly eat one or two more until all the chickens are gone. But that's what they've got in mind. It's very clear.
Is it not Solange's first position that France is God's chosen country?
Yes. And I think it's true. Does Solange Hertz not think that France is God's chosen country? It's in the Old Testament, the Jews were the chosen people, and the tribe of Judah was chosen. And in the New Testament, the Catholics are the chosen people, and arguably the equivalent of Judah, Pius X said this, arguably France is the chosen people. Now, I'm an Englishman, so I can say it. If I was French, it would be difficult for me to say it. But I do honestly believe it in many ways. Of course, it's only a comparison, so it's not an exact equivalent. But there's no doubt that God does have his favorites. There are nations which are privileged. Just like I was saying the other day, there are towns which are privileged, regions which are privileged, individuals who are privileged. And France does have a leading part to play. It has something to do with the French character. The French are more intellectual. The English are not intellectual. The English are practical. But the English language is not a good language for thinking. The Latin language is better for thinking. English, German is even worse than English. English is not a clear language. For instance, the activity of the mind, the intellect. In Latin, you've got a very exact word, intellectus and intelligit, intelligo, intelligere. In English, the activity of the mind, you can only say to know, but that's a vague word.
Deduction.
Deduction is, again, something completely different. That's deducing.
Intellection.
Intellection. That's an exact word, but that's not a verb. You have to invent the English intellige. My intellect intelliges. Otherwise, the word that Locke uses is understanding. But understand is something different. So English is poor as a language for philosophy and for thinking. English is not clear. The French language coming from Latin, descended from Latin, is a lot clearer. And the French mind is clearer. The French see things much more sharply, usually, and they see through things more sharply, and they see more logically, and they take things to their conclusion, which is why the French Revolution was bloodier and nastier than the American Revolution. The Americans are sort of English, and so they sort of moderate things and only go halfway. So there wasn't a guillotine in the American Revolution. But the French go the all of the way. If they're good, they're very, very good, and if they're bad, they're horrid. So the French Revolution is horrid, but the French Catholics, when they're good, they're very good. Archbishop Lefebvre is French. Many of the leading villains of Vatican II were French. Teilhard de Chardin, Conga, Chenu, and others. And then many of the good guys are French. The French are out in front, for good or bad. And that's the way God made them. All of these questions of the faith are much more discussed in France. You get many more books. You've got plenty of anti-liberal books. If you went into a chapel in France, you'd be astonished by the display of literature. Actually, there's quite a good display here at the seminary. But in France, the seminary display would be 2-3 times. There are books all the time being written. And people read more in France. They're more interested in ideas. They believe in ideas. The English and the Americans don't so much believe in ideas. The Catholics will tend more to believe in ideas because they're Catholic, but by our nationality, we don't take ideas seriously. The French do. Therefore, in a sense, they're more intellectual in a good sense as well as in a bad sense. They've also, what else can you say about the French? They're gifted in all round. They're good soldiers when they're inspired, when they believe in what they're fighting for. They can be very good soldiers. Napoleon conquered the whole of Europe because the soldiers were inspired. Then, when they're not inspired, they're no good at all. So you have to fire up a Frenchman to get him going. But once you get him going, you know, he's brilliant. He's dashing, he's brilliant. But, you know, if a French airport, it's also brilliant that nothing works. Whereas the American airports, they may be dumb, but most everything works except the baggage at the new Denver airport, the new baggage machine at the new Denver airport, you know. But everything works. It's practical and it works. The French are also more spiritual. They have more of a... They rise more easily. They're lighter. You can see this in their music. The German music, I personally love German music, but it's quite heavy. Brahms, Wagner, Beethoven, it's quite heavy. French music, the French are very good at Gregorian chant. It's a spiritual music, and the French are best at it, I would say. Nobody can sing Gregorian like French when the French are inspired to sing at their best. Nobody can beat them. In Europe, for many centuries, as long as France had the faith, France was always out in front. Because God gave France the gifts. You may say, why did God choose France? When you know the French, you might well ask why, you know. But Hilaire Belloc said, how odd of God to choose the Jews. But he did. And, you know, you might say strange that he chose the French, because they can be terrible, but they can be very, very good. And Archbishop Lefebvre is a classic example. Was Archbishop Lefebvre typically French? No, he was, yes and no. He was not French nationalistic. He was not that petty French who makes himself hated because he goes everywhere and crows like a cock on the top of a dung heap. And makes everybody think that France is a dung heap because he crows so much. There's a French nationalism which is very disagreeable. On the other hand, at their best, they rise to they become like international. And you're no longer sort of aware that they're French. You forget that they're French, and yet they are. And Archbishop Lefebvre is a classic example. He went all over the world. He never crowed about France, never. But he made everybody recognize that here's a great churchman, and many of his qualities were French qualities. The spirituality, the intelligence, the missionary. French missionaries for centuries have gone all over the world. They've carried the faith everywhere. Irish missionaries also. But the Irish missionaries don't have the thinking, the capacity that the French do. The Irish are brave, brave as lions. But they don't think like the French do. They don't think questions right through. And therefore many of the good theologians have been either Italian or French. The Italians can also think. And the Italians have a number, the Italians are great artists. But the French are good artists. The impressionists are French. They're gifted in many ways. And I think if you look at the history of Europe, France lost its leading position when it lost the faith. It's from the French Revolution onwards that France stopped being out in front. And when France went Masonic, the lead naturally went to England and America, which are the natural Masonic countries. And France will only come back in front when she comes back to the faith. But when she comes back to the faith, you will see her right out in front again. I'll bet you good money.
She was called a daughter.
Yes, the oldest daughter of the church. It's a strange thing that God should choose a nation like that. But I've lived with the French. I've worked with the French. I was with Archbishop Lefebvre for several years. I've watched the whole question. I've got no axe to grind, precisely because I'm English. I'd much rather think that England was the top dog, or ought to be the top dog. But as far as God is concerned, it's clear to me that he uses the French in a special way. Part of the mission of France is to be the right arm of the papacy. The papacy is Italian, but France is meant to provide the strength to defend the Italians. Italians as soldiers are not exactly top class. So you know, the Italians are not going to be very good when it comes to defending. But then, when the French defend the papacy, then you've got a strong combination. And that's how it ought to be. Spain has a mission, a colonizing mission. And you know, you won't get many Spaniards to admit that France is meant to be top nation. You won't get many Englishmen to admit it. But I think Solange Hertz, I think, had a French mother. But I think she's right. I think it's true. And at their best, the French are very, very good. At their best, you forget that they're French. They're just Catholic. And they're serving the faith, and they're very good at it. They're missionaries. They're the best of missionaries, in a way.
When you compare their bookstores, I'll bet they don't have Tarzan of the Apes.
They have Asterix. They have the equivalent. And you know, they have terrible pornography like everywhere else. France is in a terrible state now. And the old saying is, the higher they are, the harder they fall. And the higher France was meant to be, the lower and more degraded it is today. And you and I think, that the dear United States is corrupt. But you know, if let's suppose that France was meant to be on top, and I'll put Britain underneath, and then they both go corrupt. Well, Britain will come down here, but France will be much worse. The higher it was, the harder it falls. And therefore, plenty of Americans think the corruption in the United States is terrible, but the corruption in Europe is worse. Many people will say, and I think it's true, that the pornography on the average bookstand in Europe is worse than the pornography here. I think it's true.
Well, things they don't even consider pornography, we would consider pornography. I mean, showing women's breasts and stuff on newspapers is normal.
Yes, it's bad. It's bad, bad, bad. Europe. The American seminarians went on a visit to Europe. About 15, 20 of them went 2 summers ago, I think it was. And they noticed the contrast between the magnificent history, full of the faith, all of these great monuments, demonstrations of how the faith must have been once, and then the pygmies running around amongst these monuments, covering them with graffiti, you know, with no sense of their glorious past and behaving way underneath. And the contrast struck the seminarians, because the seminarians have the faith. So they had a sense of what these monuments meant. But the people now living amongst them have practically no sense at all. It's an incredible disaster, especially in France. France has given itself over to the devils of the revolution, And it's going to take a terrible part of chastisement to bring France to senses. But Pius X told the French they would come back. It's a famous speech of Pius X in about 1910, a famous prophecy. He told them, you will come back. And it's a great consolation to the French. But for the moment, but for instance, tradition at the moment is numerically strongest in France. And the French are those that do most thinking on all of the questions of tradition. For instance, and if you want to read the anti-liberal writers, you need to be able to read French, because most of the good ones are in French. Another thing I've noticed, for instance, Professor Derman wrote these excellent books in German, but they only really began to circulate when they were translated into French. And that's typical. You get translated into French, and then the ideas really move. But until it's in French, it's liable to be blocked. It's very strange, but that's how it is. The French of, for instance, I don't know if you've ever heard of Dr. John Senior. You've heard of him, yes. He's an American that he thinks, definitely. And he's written two books, quite interesting books, quite recently, about culture and traditions, so on and so on. Both have been translated into French, and both are circulating in France. The French read him. I don't know how many people read him here. Some, but probably not many. Probably not many. I'll bet you more people are reading him over in France than are reading him here. And that's typical. So this is a people which is made to think and think out in front and look. They're like the scouts that are exploring and then piercing, and then the others follow. That's what they're made for. And therefore, I do think it's true. I think each country has its mission. Each country is meant by God to do what it does best. Each country has different qualities. But France definitely has, from purposes of the faith and the Christian civilization, a leading part to play, if not the leading part to play. What is the mission of the United States? I think if you look at the church 70, 80 years ago, the American church certainly did a lot of financing of Catholics all over the world.
That's important. Right? No, I mean, that's important.
It is important.
I mean, it was the American wealth that allowed much of the missionary work in the Third World.
Yes, it is important. And American Catholics were generous, and to this day they are generous. If you get hold of their faith and give them the faith, you give them the dogma, they will give you the dollars. And that's true today. And you know, an army, finance is money is the sinews of war. And to this day, Germany also, for instance, a good part of Germany's mission is providing the finance too. The Germans have great qualities, not the same qualities as the French, and they're not leading qualities. The Germans need the French to do their thinking for them, so does, and we all do in a sense. And when the French thinking went bad with Descartes, Descartes crossed over the frontier into Germany and came back in the form, 100 years later, came back in the form of Kant. Wow. France shipped over to Germany a whammy, and Germany shipped back a double whammy. Again, the Germans, they drive things to conclusions, but not the same way as the French. The Germans drive things into action. The French drive the logic to its conclusion. The Germans drive the action to its conclusion. They're different. Again, the Italians are different. The Spaniards, all of the nations are different. They're meant to be, like individuals are all different and all their talents are meant to intermix and complement one another, the same thing with the nations. The nations have very different talents and gifts, and they're meant to work together in the symphony of nations and complement one another. And that's how it should be, and that's how it would be. That's how it used to be in the Catholic Church. And the American Church, I'm not saying that it was only meant to finance, but that's one thing that it definitely did do. And America, I think to this day, Rome is much dependent upon American money, American Catholic money, I think so.
70% of their income comes from the United States and West
yes.
Germany.
There we are, 70% from the United States and West Germany, that makes sense.
Yeah. And that's the reason why the American bishops get by with what they do.
Yes.
Because they don't want to upset
Yes, that figures. It's unfortunate for the American bishops, but they buy their way through that. I think that's true. Mr. Perry.
I mean, just wasn't that part of the plan in getting rid of the Papal States? was so that the papacy would be totally dependent for funds upon the various countries, wouldn't have a base of finance of its own.
Yes.
And whoever's supplying the dollars gets to pull a lot of strings.
Yes, yes, yes.
And when it happened, we were the up-and-coming big boys.
Yes, that figures. That figures. Is that part of, is that America's mission? America, 50, 60, 70 years ago, sent a lot of missionaries. There were a lot of Catholic missionaries from America. That's an Irish, a great Irish tradition. But there were, and there are quite a few by now, there have been in the society, there are a number of foreign priests in the United States, but there are also quite a few American priests all over the world by now. So the Marinol, well, of course, the Marinols have gone wrong by now, but they were, there was a missionary drive. There was a missionary drive. There's certainly not a mission to liberalize the church. The Bishop England and Bishop Ireland in the last century thought that the American Catholic Church had a mission to introduce American ideas into the Catholic Church. That's a disaster. That's obviously not what God meant. But that's what several Americans have thought. And unfortunately, many Americans think that the great quality of their country is this liberal crusade to establish democracy all over the face of the earth. And it's deadly. That's not what God meant America for, or the United States for. Certainly not. Yes.
What about the situation of the faith in Portugal? In Paramus, that Portugal would not lose the faith.
But what about the situation of the faith in Fatima? Again, that's an interesting question. In the third secret, Our Lady did say that Portugal, the dogma of the faith will never be lost in Portugal. Our colleagues, our society colleagues in Portugal say, the churchmen certainly seem to be going modernist, in which case the churchmen in Portugal certainly seem to be losing the faith. They have difficulty, our colleagues in Portugal have difficulty interpreting those words of Our Lady. They're not quite sure what the words mean. But they have to, I think they guess that what it must mean is that the faith is still there amongst the people, amongst the little people. For instance, in Fatima today, I think you will still find many, many Portuguese people on the great Fatima feast, October the 13th and May the 13th. Huge, even a million people you're liable to find in Portugal. And you will always find, I think, Portuguese pilgrims doing penance at Fatima, covering hundreds and hundreds of yards on their knees on the last stretch up to the sanctuary. Again, that's the faith in amongst the people. But the clergy are not very good, apparently. And our center in Portugal has very few people. The society has all kinds of difficulties. In Quebec, the parts of the world that were most Catholic yesterday, very difficult today. Quebec, Ireland, Italy, Spain, very difficult to break through. But France was Catholic yesterday. But it's again, it's out in front of tradition today. Why? Partly because France also has this revolutionary tradition, like America. People find it easier to be quote-unquote disobedient in France than America because of the revolutionary tradition. So just as the Masons are now the best guardians of the buildings, the revolutionaries are the best guardians of tradition. I mean, faith... Providence has its strange way of acting so that, you know, things that ought to not to work well suddenly by accident turn out working well. But Portugal is very difficult. And there are only, I think, a few dozen people in our chapel. That's what I've heard recently. Only a few dozen people in our... A few dozen regular Portuguese in our chapel in Portugal. In Spain, it's also difficult. Because they're too papist. They're too faithful to the Pope. Ireland, the same thing. Mexico has got there's a lot of movement, there's a lot of action in Mexico.
It was basically Catholic.
It was very Catholic, but again, there's something of a revolutionary tradition in Mexico, and the Mexicans easily get very hot under the collar. Yes, I think so. And therefore, we have got some quite big centers. We have got some quite big centers in Mexico country. And quite a lot, quite a large following. Numerically. Yes.
Is where is the society growing the most right now?
That's an interesting question. Where is the society growing the most right now? I'm not sure. I can't. I don't know. I don't think it's growing much anywhere. Perhaps it's growing at the moment quite well in the Philippines, which of course is a Catholic country, thanks to the Spanish colonialists. And it's the only really Catholic country in Asia, except perhaps Vietnam, thanks to the French. But other than that, I think the tradition is only moving forward little by little. It's not a spectacular advance. You'd have to describe it rather, I think, as a holding action. They're holding rather than making great advances.